Lema Bowie was born in a poor village in the West African nation of Liberia, but that didn't stop her from changing the world once she discovered the power of her voice.
I think I found it and I lost it and I found it again. But I think growing up as a child, by the time I entered high school, I knew that my voice would be my greatest gift and that I could use it for the good of humanity. Yeah.
Ms. Bowie founded a women's movement in Liberia to help bring an end to her nation's long and brutal civil wars. Her success and her forceful voice on behalf of women were recognized with the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. The 2018 Nobel Peace Prize was just announced 2 weeks ago as I record this podcast, and the honorees are two people who, again, have bravely stood up for women around the world. So it seemed like the right moment to spend some time with Lema Bowie, to be inspired by her story, and celebrate the power of one person to bring about change. This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Right from the start, Lema Bowie's father called her his lucky charm. He had been unemployed when his first three daughters were born, but soon after Lema arrived, he landed a job. Still, for several years, the family lived very modestly. What they had plenty of always, she says, was affection, love, and community. And those gave her the grounding she would need to start a women's movement, a peace movement, years later. Bowie, which, by the way, is spelled G-B-O-W-E-E, described her early childhood to Mary Jordan, the Washington Post reporter who interviewed her for the Academy of Achievement in September of 2018.
When we lived in that community, it was a poor community. It wasn't a rich community, but we didn't know poverty. Because every child took their bath. So if I went to the next door house and it was 6 p.m., the neighbor gave me a bath and put an oversized t-shirt on me and sent me home. If we came from school and they had not finished making our meal, someone would offer us a meal. The way we lived was our back porch was someone's front porch, and someone's front porch was our kitchen, like very cluster community. It was not until my father in the early 90s built a house that he called his dream house, when we moved out of that community, that we knew that people were hungry. When two kids appeared on our doorstep one day and said they had not had breakfast, my sister and I, 17 and 19, look at each other and were like, you 2, 3-year-old and 5-year-old have not eaten, because they came with an empty bowl to our house to say, we're hungry, can you give us food? But all of our growing up years, that was the first time we had seen that. And so when I started the movement, I would say that even though we moved out of that community, but that socialization was solid. The foundation of the South Africans who say Ubuntu, I am because of what we all are, was solid in me. So it's that mindset that I took into the women's movement.
But that was still down the road. Bowie's family, she explained, had been living in a bubble. Not a rich bubble, but a closely knit, have each other's back kind of bubble. Then, as her family began to move up the ladder, they moved to the capital, Monrovia.
At 17, I was fresh out of high school. I had the world ahead of me. I was going to college to be a pediatrician. I was going to marry my dream boyfriend and have two children with a white picket fence, live my dream life. And my dad was working with the government National Security Agency. Things are getting quite good for us. So we were now a middle-class family. My mom worked at the National Hospital as one of the senior dispensers in their pharmacy. And Monrovia children, I would say at my age, we weren't really involved in the politics of our time. We're involved in our own politics. So life was booming for us.
Then suddenly, the ground gave way.
How old were you when the war started?
2 days after my high school graduation was when the war started at the border. So 17, right after high school.
And how did life change when the Civil War broke out?
Well, that July, my parents had gone to, my mom left to go to work. My dad did not come home the night before. And so I was the only one at home when the shooting erupted in that part of where we moved at the time. And I tell the story that in 1 minute, I was a teenager, and the next minute, I was an adult taking care of over 20 people who had come. They were internally displaced. I was the only child of my parent old enough living in the house at the time. So my aunties and those around said I had to take the responsibility of taking care. So you move from that child who was pampered, dependent on everyone, into deciding who sleep where, what documents to find to keep if you had to run, making decisions about if someone died, where you all would bury them. So 1 minute we're sitting there, and then all of a sudden shooting erupted. I have to collect my sister, kids, my two younger siblings, and then I became a head of a household. And it never went back to normal until today. Because then by the time my mother came, she was so traumatized that she couldn't do anything. So I had to function for her. I had to think, let's go this place, let's come this place, let's do this. So people would come and they would say, we need this. And she would say, talk to Lima. And I'll be like, I've been waiting for a week for you to come home and take over your life. But eventually I realized that that would not be the case, even up until we went to refugee camp.
There were two almost back-to-back civil wars in Liberia between 1989 and 2003. They were unspeakably violent. Children were forced to fight. They were drugged and were sometimes made to kill their own parents. Rape was a common weapon used against both women and young girls. A third of Liberians were displaced, refugees, both inside their country and out. And almost a tenth of the population was killed.
How bad did it get? Over a quarter of a million people in a relatively small country died in that war. What was the depths of the war for you?
Oh, my God. I will keep referring back to my socialization. I never saw a dead person until I was 17. That's how protected and sheltered we were. The first time I saw a dead person was when we were walking in late July of 1990. This woman had been shot apparently, but she was still clinging onto her Bible and the dogs were eating her body. I froze. That was the first time in my entire life I had seen a dead person. And it got so bad that by the time the war ended, I was in my 30s, I could eat with a dead person around me. So you move from being afraid to not being afraid, from being afraid of the shooting to moving around and trying to fend for food in the midst of the shooting. When the war started, yes, they were killing people, shooting people, but as it dragged on, the fighters and those who had the guns begin to think about very creative ways of killing people. Stories I've told of women who were walking, coming to a checkpoint, they were pregnant, the soldiers would put a bet on them that she's carrying a boy, no, she's carrying a girl, and they would open up the stomach to know the sex of the child. So these are things that it was really, really bad. And we've been, 14, 15 years since the end of the war, but I think it's going to take us decades to get our humanity back, to get the infrastructure developed, to get us to that place where we can look at each other again and not be suspicious that this person is a potential killer.
How did you shield yourself from the brutality? Or how did you keep functioning when they were doing things like slitting open a pregnant woman's stomach and shooting people in church?
I was very angry. I was a very, very angry young woman. growing up, I grew up in a home that I tell people my grandmother, she's 111 and is still alive today. The way we woke up in the morning, my sister, Josephine, and I, because we were the ones who would sleep in her bedroom, Ma would wake up and kneel down at the foot of her bed. Until this day, I remember her prayers. She started with all powerful, almighty God. And then she thanked him for her children and her grandchildren. And she went on down that line. And so we grew up with a strong sense of God, a strong sense of a prayer answering God. And when the war started, December, we prayed. January, February, March, April, May, June, July. By July, when we had come close to a near-death experience, I didn't want to hear the word God anymore. And so it was just that anger that was taking me. I was just very angry up until the point we left Liberia and went into exile in Ghana. So I really don't think I shielded myself. I think just playing a role as the protector of my mother and my nephew and nieces, or the one who will wake up in the morning and will say, oh, you need to walk 2 hours from here to go and find food for us. I was just existing, I would think. So it wasn't about trying to protect myself from anything or trying to shield myself from anything. I had a role to play. And I think my person disconnected from that girl who was out in the streets.
What was your role to play?
My role to play was to go pass through checkpoints. I remember one time they gave me a huge catch of cash to take to my grandmother because they were on the other side and there was no food. And I had to put the cash in my underwear and wear it like a sanitary pad. Because if I had gone through a checkpoint and found that kind of money on me, I could get killed. But even walking alone as a young woman with that kind of money through a checkpoint was a risk. But it was nothing. I never thought about it. It was just that my family needed me. My mother couldn't do it. It was my role.
And you made it that day?
I did. I took the money, and many other days I would cross over to different places to get food, either going to get vegetables for us to eat or going to check on this other family member. I still have those images still today.
There were other times when luck was all that stood between her and a violent death, like the time she and her cousin were in line at a store, desperate for food. A soldier outside looked at her and shook his head no, as if warning her. Sure enough, a moment later, shooting broke out.
Later on, we learned that everyone who had entered that store did not make it out.
Another time, she and some of her family members were among a group of people pulled by rebels from a Lutheran church guest house where they'd taken refuge. They were lined up against a wall. Several people, who were identified as government officials, were pulled from the wall and shot on the spot. The next day, 200 people were killed inside that church.
Talk about trauma. You've done a lot of work in trying to heal people in trauma. What's the key to that, do you think?
Well, I think when it comes to the healing process, the one recognition that people must have is that trauma is like a physical wound. Whilst the wound will heal, you always have the scars. And so we all still go around with the scars of the war. It's never, so you may heal that, like if I have a cut, the cut may heal, but people will always know that. So that's what we carry in our hearts, in our minds, in our souls, that we have these wounds, that the scars from these wounds that may never, ever go away. Those scars will never go away.
Is there something to do to minimize the scars?
Oh, I think one of the things, it's not, no, you can't do anything to minimize the scars. What you do is to try to work your way through healing of the pain, because some people's wounds are still very fresh. The way I was able to do mine was to be able to talk about it in different circles and spaces at different times, in different moments, just to talk about it. And today I can talk about my experiences of the war without wanting to revenge, but with a lot of, yes. So that is how I know that I'm healed, but I still carry the scar.
You've said that it's fine, probably good to be angry, but poisonous to have hate.
Yeah. I see anger in my life as the fuel, to move me into action. But hate, it immobilizes you. It takes away creativity. And someone will ask you, so what's the difference between anger and hate? Everyone is angry. Dr. King was an angry man. Gandhi was an angry man. Mother Teresa was an angry woman. The difference, the thing that distinguishes a great angry person from a villain is that those who are angry, when you're able to tap into that anger and use it for good. Hitler was an angry man, but his anger turned to hate, and he was able to unleash that. So anger is like water, it's fluid.
When Lema Bowie talks to students these days, what she tells them is that if you let your anger turn to hate, you will have gangrene in your heart. She had plenty of anger, rage really, but because she was determined to use it for good, she was able to devise creative, nonviolent strategies. One actually came to her in a dream.
Well, the dream was lying in my room and on the floor. My kids had moved to Ghana as refugees. I was lonely because my whole world was built around those children. And so I poured myself into my work. And this night, out of nowhere, I had this dream where the voice was telling me, gather the women to pray for peace. So I went to work and went to my boss and said to him, you know, I had this strange dream. And since you're a pastor, my boss at the time was a pastor, I think you should tell the women of the church to come together to pray for peace. And he looked at me and said to me, no, Lema, the dream bearer is always the dream carrier. If you give your dream to someone, you may never recognize it when you see it the next time. So you have to mobilize those women. And I was like, but God could not be talking to me because I drink. I'm in a relationship where I'm not married. So everything that the Bible tells you is wrong is what I was reciting to him. And he said, yeah, I know that, but he called you.
She started by talking to women in her own church, then other churches. And then she realized she would need to reach a hand across the religious divide. So she visited mosques and invited Muslim women to join her. A unified front was the only way. The movement called Women of Liberia Mass Action for Peace built quickly. They started by praying and singing at a fish market. Then one day, with Lema Bowie as their leader, nearly 2,500 women put on white clothes and white head wraps and gathered on a field near the Capitol building with signs demanding peace. They knew that Charles Taylor would have to pass their protest every day on his way to and from work. Taylor, of course, was the former rebel leader and warlord who had become Liberia's bloodthirsty president. He ordered them to stop. They didn't. That sea of white remained there, growing day after day through excruciating heat and miserable rain. They became a source of strength to one another in an unbearable time.
What was the key moment for you that you realized the power of women to stop war?
I think the key moment for me was when first it came slowly. So we went to Parliament to protest in the early days of our movement, and the Speaker of Parliament came. He was very angry, and he wanted to know who the leader of the group was. And I stood up and said, I'm the leader. And he said to me, why are you using those women? I don't know where the courage came from. I was so mad. I told him his truth, and he got so mad. But for a second, people thought we were going to fight physically because I was in his face. Unfortunately for him, he was this short. So I could talk over his head. The next day, he came to where we were seated, where we used to protest. And he sat in his car and sent his bodyguard to say that he needed to talk to me. And the bodyguard came and said, the speaker wants to talk to you. I said, well, tell the speaker I'm in my office. Let him get down and walk to me. When I saw him, I was trying to be brave. He opened the door, walked to me, and said, I need to talk to you. I stood up, we walked, and he said, this is to tell you that President Taylor will meet with you all. That was the second thing. And it was like, wow. And then we get to go to meet President Taylor, 2,500 women.
You're all wearing white shirts.
Everyone. So we get in, and the security comes to me and said, the president says, you are too many. You should find 10 people to come upstairs in his office to talk to him. I said, show me the way to the president's office. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to tell him no. So I walk past this guy, and I'm going in. Two or three other people following me. And by the time we go up the stairs and we're going up to get on the elevator, and the guards are running after me and say, this is problematic. Why are you so troublesome? Come back. I said, no, we came to see him. And all of us will see him. It's either he come down to see us or there's no meeting. And then right midway, I think he's watching us on camera. They said, go back. He's coming down to meet you all. At that moment, I was like, okay, we got it.
Lema Bowie brought a short, prepared statement to read. She addressed it to the only woman official there, the president of the Senate. But the whole time she spoke, she looked directly at Charles Taylor, who masked his eyes with dark sunglasses. This is the actual recording from that day.
We are tired of war. We are tired running. We are tired begging for bugger. We are tired of our children being raped. Kindly convey this to the president of Liberia. Thank you.
Let's remind people that Charles Taylor would go on to be convicted as one of the biggest war criminals ever.
Yeah. I feel sorry for him. Because Taylor, I will use the words of another Liberian politician, he was given the opportunity to be a leader. He decided to be a ruler. He had everything to change his image from the warlord to the greatest leader who led Liberia to prosperity, but he chose to continue on a path of tyranny and terror.
And he's spending the rest of his life in jail.
Yep.
When he was convicted in The Hague of war crimes, they said he had perpetrated some of the worst crimes, heinous crimes that
against
humanity. Yeah. There were child soldiers. This was a man who had a lot of blood on his hands. You walked into his office and said, no, I'm not coming to you,
no,
you come to me.
So
where did you get that? Where did you get that courage?
You know, I think there is a moment in everyone's life, we all have it, when you're pushed so far back against the wall, you have two options. Allow that wall to swallow you or fight back. And when you're fighting back, even if it is a child, that is when the Liberians will say, you don't give a damn. You're just fighting back. And that is where I was, because I was living the war with those women on a daily basis. Whether if it was the ones that had been raped repeatedly. One of the leaders of that group, who came every day from the internally displaced camp, had so much energy, was giving people so much hope. One day she sat down with me to tell her story that the soldiers had come to arrest someone, and she went and stood up for this person, and those soldiers decided to strip her naked in a camp of 20,000 people and ask her to walk butt naked in the streets of that camp and pick up paper. And as she was picking up paper, they were inserting their AK-47 in her private parts. But that incident happened, and afterwards they took her, five men raped her, but she came back the next day to protest for peace. And she's telling me the story and say, I will not stop until this stops. So every moment I was standing either in front of a warlord or in front of Taylor's people, it wasn't about me. It was never. Until this day, even up until now, the work that I do, it is not about me. It is about those people that I represent, or those women in other parts of the world, even as we're speaking now, who are going through similar things.
That day that Lema Bowie spoke to Charles Taylor, by the way, it was only the movement's first victory, one step toward getting Taylor and the warring rebel factions to agree to sit down for peace talks in nearby Ghana. But it emboldened the women to try whatever nonviolent tactics they could think of. Take, for instance, the sex strike.
Well, I can't take credit for that idea. I always say to people, there is always a myth and misconception about the different religious groups in our world, and that sex strike idea came from a Muslim woman, Asatu Ba Kenneth. Today, she's the deputy of immigration in Liberia, a career police officer. She was like, we should have a sex strike.
And what did you say?
Sure. Well, I didn't have a lot to worry about because I wasn't married at the time.
So you were telling people, basically telling the men in power and the men with guns that there's going to be no sex until you get to the...
You sign the peace accord until you go to the peace table. And the women in our movement go around 9 counties were being told you can't have sex with your husband. So you either put it that you're praying, you're fasting, whatever way you can put it. But until we have peace, we have to do a sex strike. Later did we know that the whole idea of a sex strike was the best media strategy. Because at the time, we're being ignored. If you look at the state of our world, media is anything sexy, anything they sell. So once we said sex strike, everyone was at our door the next morning wanting to know how a group of African women were going to accomplish a sex strike. So whilst we'll talk about it, but we'll also add the story of the essence of our protest.
So you were telling people, basically telling the men in power and the men with guns that there's going to be no sex until you get to the...
You sign the peace accord until you go to the peace table. And the women in our movement go around 9 counties were being told you can't have sex with your husband. So you either put it that you're praying, you're fasting, whatever way you can put it. But until we have peace, we have to do a sex strike. It was more successful in the rural areas than the urban areas because the women were, in one particular area, the women took their husbands into the mosques, into the church, and made them to vow to God that they would not bother them for sex until peace came.
So it really worked in some places?
It worked in some places, but other places it did not work, not in the city. It lasted probably for 2 weeks in the city, and then so we had to re-strategize two different things here.
Here's one thing they did once the peace talks in Ghana had finally started, but were floundering.
We locked the delegates in. So we had sent a note, hostage note, in to say they were not going to come out for food and water or to use the bathroom unless they signed an agreement. And it was at that point that the security said they were going to arrest me.
And then you said, well, then I'll take my clothes off.
Yeah.
Wow. Did it work?
It did. In our culture, in many other African cultures, including mine, is a curse for a woman to undress, you know, because she's dissatisfied with something, you know. So when we were being arrested in Ghana for locking the peace hall, I told myself that this was a total contradiction of the spirit of Ubuntu that I talked about, the togetherness I am because of what we all are. For you, I have been socialized to believe that the weak would be taken care of by the strong. And all of those things that I talked about growing up, when I was being told I was being arrested for obstructing justice, everything that I've ever believed in crumbled before my eyes. And to protest the destruction of my socialization, my childhood, my belief system, I was prepared to strip naked. And when I said I was going to do so, the soldiers, the police left. Mingo, they ran away, and the guys in the room, one of the warlords would later on tell that there was not a single man in that room that did not question what they've done to contribute to bringing their women to that place, where they were willing to disgrace themselves in protest of. Is one thing, because I always get this question, so what stripping naked would have done for a nation where women have been raped, about 65% of the population of women have been raped? There's a huge difference in being forced, your clothes being torn off, than willingly taking off your clothes in protest, that's a huge difference.
65% of women in Liberia have been raped. So it's one
thing. Or sexually assaulted.
It's fascinating that that tactic, that you thought of that. I mean, did you say, I'm going to do this?
Yes, I already started. The hair gear was gone. The skirt was being loosened. Yeah.
And do you think you would have gotten other women to do it too?
Oh, they already started next to me.
And then what was the moment that they just said fine?
No, they backed off. The mediator came out and we were crying. I was upset. And they took us into a room to negotiate with us. But that particular moment would be the turning point of the Liberian peace talks.
It was a turning point because you stood up.
Yes.
You didn't get arrested.
No.
And you retained the power. Do you have other tactics still to come in the future?
Well, sometimes you don't overthink too much when you have to. A girl got to do what she has to do for peace, you know, for justice, for human rights.
You wrote, I think it was in Mighty Be Our Powers, your memoir, that a culture of impunity flourished throughout Africa. People, officials, governments, they did evil, but were never held accountable. More than we needed to punish them, we needed to undo the damage they had done.
Yeah. And it's still true to today. Because impunity is the big word that hangs over the continent. People can do whatever the hell they want to do. And as long as they still have the money, they still will power, no one will hold them accountable. We're still on a huge fight in Liberia for them to establish some kind of court for someone like Prince Johnson, the warlord, and others who did terrible harm to the Liberian people to be held accountable for what they've done. How else do we mentor or socialize the next generation of leaders that it's okay to rape, kill, and maim people, and you can be a leader and you protect yourself? No, we need to begin to lay down rules that would really help us to get to the place that we need to get to. People are worried and upset about the level of leadership that we're seeing around the world. Until we can change the way we do justice, truth, peace, reconciliation, and human rights, we will continue to see the worst kind of leaders in any kind of state power, because the world has made it okay for those kind of people to rule.
You've written so many interesting things, including about how so many men in the country didn't even know who they were if they didn't have a gun in their hands, and how did you slowly try to change that, and the women in your movement try to change that?
I think the process is still on for some generation of people. I think the process is still on because it's been 15 years since the end of the war. We've gone through two democratic processes, but it was a mindset. I'll tell you a story. When I used to work with child soldiers many years ago, I was trying to break down rape with some of them. And when I said rape, all of them said to me, no, we never rape anyone. And I realized that they didn't understand the concept. So the question was, did you ever force a woman to have sex? Oh, that, yeah. Isn't that what women are made for?
They didn't think anything was wrong with it.
No. And so...
And who do you blame for that thinking?
You want to say society? And this is not unique to Liberia. I'll tell you one thing. After I had that situation, my daughter, fast forward maybe 5 or 6 years later or more, we moved to Ghana, and my 8-year-old at the time went to school on International Women's Day, and she's this bubbly young feminist. And she goes to school and tells all of the young children, today is International Women's Day, the boys have to be nice to the girls. And this little boy stands up, this is Ghana. Ghana has never gone to war. and say, sit down and shut up. What are women good for just to make babies? When she came home and told me that, my mind went back to my conversation 8 years before. And the only thing that came to my mind was, if you put a gun in that boy's hand, he would do exactly what these boys did. And this is the tax of our now. Because I think it's the same here. The way women are objectified, the way some young people in some communities are socialized to believe that this total sum of a woman is from here to here, up here is nothing. Until we can change that mindset, we'll continue to have those kinds of horrific rape and abuse with a whole society or a whole generation of young people who doesn't see it as doing anything wrong. Our former president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and Elizabeth Rand, they did the first article for the UN on women, peace, and security. And one of their conclusions on the page or the chapter on sexual violence was that the impact of conflict on women's lives is a reflection of the interaction in peacetime. And that I have seen since I read that in all of the years that I've done my work to be true.
So right around the world, rape has been used,
yes,
as a weapon of war, and it's a reflection of, in peacetime,
the thinking of
men and society.
Yeah.
How many kids do you have?
Eight wonderful children. I find myself extremely blessed to have those group of young people who know exactly where they're going, but they take so much care of me, and they're so concerned about me. If I'm having a bad day, they talk to me, but they also keep me grounded in my calling.
And what do you tell both your sons and daughters about the role of women?
Well, I feel sorry for my sons. I have three. I think it's a very difficult place to be the son to a very strong African feminist. No if, but, or whatever. My feminism is unquestionable. Because even when the African in me try to, you know, say, girls, can you do this? The girls will remind me. We notice that you've been asking us to do a lot of kitchen stuff while your sons are sitting. And then I have to so my daughters, they keep me. But I try not to talk a lot. I try to lead by example, you know. So I see them pick up stuff, you know, from me, the way they treat women. I hope the way they do it in front of me is how they're doing it when I'm not around. But I tell them that we're equals. There is no way. The way I see the world, men and women, is like your left and right eye. If you leave one person out, you can't see the whole picture clearly. So my sons know that very well. And it's important for me for them to respect women, for them to understand that we're partners in this world. And we are not. So we have this common saying, God didn't take woman from the man's head for him to lord over her. He didn't take from the feet for him to kick her. He took from the side so that they're equal partners in every venture. So from very young age, those were the kinds of stories that we tell in the house about partnership between men and women. But I often told my sons when they're getting married, I have a special gift for their wives, and it's going to be packaged, and the wife is going to keep it until the day one of them raised their hand on her. Then she has to call me so that we unwrap that gift. And then they say, Mama, what is the gift? I say, it's a cane. I'm going to wrap it nicely and give it to your wife, because the day any of you touch your wives, we'll unwrap that cane, that wife and I will flog the hell out of you. You will never touch another woman in your life. So we have that understanding. So, yeah.
Wow. That's quite a wedding present.
Indeed. But as you might be starting to suspect, Lema Bowie herself was abused for years by her first husband, and the traumas only built until she sought solace in alcohol. Lots of alcohol, she says. There were the psychic wounds of the war, of course, and the period of extreme poverty in her 20s, when she couldn't afford food and had no money to pay the hospital when one of her children was born 2 months premature. Later on, one of her sisters died, and she had periods of long separation from her kids during the war and after, when she left to further her education. She was finally able to beat her alcoholism with the support of her second husband and her kids after a terrifying incident when she passed out from pain in her esophagus.
You talk a lot about God, your faith. It's important to you.
Extremely important. I doubt if without God I would be where I am. I see my journey as, and that's why I'm able to endure some of the things that I endure. That's why I'm able to keep going. That's why I'm able to really rise above some of the difficulties, because I never see what I do as a day's job. I see it as a call from God. So I'm on a journey of peace activism, but it's also a spiritual journey.
But on this call from God, do you ever ask him, why are 250,000 people killed?
Oh my God, yes, we have conversations. You should be there. You think I've lost my mind. Sometimes I put a chair down and say, hey God, let's have a conversation. That
why? How does it go? Tell us a little bit about the conversation. Well,
sometimes it's like, you know, I'll tell you a story. I was in the Congo several years ago, and I wrote an article about that experience. And we had gone around with all of these fantastic activists all day. And midway through the trip, that night I had come from, went to my hotel room, sat down to get on my laptop to check emails. And then I heard all this commotion. He's a bad man. He's a bad man. So ran out of my hotel room, look up, there's this girl screaming, he's a bad man. He wants to do something bad to me. So, of course, the feminist in me is mobilized right there and then. So everyone came running, police and every different group of people coming running towards. So we go to that room, and whatever they talk in there, these people drag this girl out, and they're punching her, beating her. And she's naked, and they're about to throw her in a pickup. So I run there and beg them to release her to me, that whatever the problem was, we could sort it out. And no one was listening to me. This is a big shot international aid worker who had taken this girl in his room to have his way with her. And the police came. Instead of protecting her, he got protected, and she got beaten and taken away. So I went in my room angry, crying, mad. First thing first, why did I have to be in the Congo to see this at this moment? God, why is this my life? So those are the moments where I'm just challenging him and asking him questions. And then at the end of it all, there's still small voices. So what do you do about it? You can't fight, but you have your intellect. So I sit down and I write this article and send it off. And someone would say, so what did writing that article do? It did something.
What did it do?
It created the awareness that this is the kind of madness that is happening in countries that are going through conflict.
Do you see that as your role now, to raise awareness for this that's going on? Because it's still happening.
To raise awareness, to fight when I'm physically present, and to use my voice to challenge the status quo. I tell people, I've always been poor in terms of resources, money, but I'm not a poor person. So the wealth of strength, the wealth of intelligence, the wealth of a platform, I'm going to use it to make good the space that I find myself in. But this is how I teach it to young children. So close your eyes and imagine that the problems of the world is a big round ball. So that's all of the problems of the world, big. And you have every problem on that ball. It is a whole ball, right? And then you write an article to create an awareness. And someone is mobilized to do something about it. Bim! You've chipped off a tiny piece of that ball. Is it whole again? It's not whole anymore because something has been taken out of it. So imagine if all of us were surrounding the problems of the world in this big ball and chipping out our tiny bit. Some people will be creating awareness. Some people will be mobilizing group. By the time we all do what we can do, it's not a whole ball anymore. Maybe 1% of it has been chipped off. You know what you've done? You've saved 1% of the world from a catastrophe. That's how I see it.
That's a pretty great place to end. But there's still that little matter of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize. Lema Bowie shared the prize with two other women who led struggles for peace and for the safety and rights of women. One was Yemeni journalist Tawakkul Karman, a leader of the Arab Spring, and the other was Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was president of Liberia from 2006 to 2018, the first female head of state in Africa. As a sidebar, Lema Bowie campaigned for Sirleaf when she ran, and Sirleaf is widely seen around the world as someone who, against tremendous odds, brought stability to her country and began the recovery process. But inside Liberia, she's been criticized by Lema Bowie and many others for the kind of corruption and cronyism she campaigned against. Bowie says she felt it was her responsibility as a troublemaker and a truth teller to call out her former compadre. President Sirleaf has her own version of events, but that's better left, I think, to another podcast. We are here to listen to Lema Bowie's remarkable story.
Tell us about the moment, the call, or was it a call, or how did you hear that you won the Nobel Peace Prize?
That's the craziest story in the world. So I had spent the night promoting. First, after we wrote the book, I got a grant from the founder of Barnes & Nobles to do a tour. He said to me, this is the story of my mother. This is the story of women everywhere. And I want you to go around the country and tell this story.
This was the founder of Barnes & Noble's bookstore said this to you?
Yeah, Len Reggio.
Wow.
And I don't know if I'm supposed to tell this, but I have to. I'm always giving credit. So Len has said this to me in a meeting. And so he put this money up for me to do the book tour. So I started the tour, and my last stop was in California at Sheryl Sandberg's house. It was a wonderful evening. And when she introduced me to give my talk, she said, the Nobel is up tomorrow, and my pick is you, Lema. And I was like, Sheryl, stop. Don't say that. I don't do these things for accolades. She said, well, but I still pick you. And we laughed, had a great night.
Did you think you would win?
No. The story had come out, even in newspapers in Liberia, in February, as far back as February, that I was on the short list, but I'd never internalized it. I'd never thought about it. I never saw myself as a Nobel contender. You know, it's not that I'm minimizing, and this is not self-hate. It's just that the work that I did, the work that the women did, was for our future and the future of our children. You know, it was trying to change from existing to having a future. You know, so...
So you're joking out with Sheryl Sandberg?
Yes, and all of her guests. But then also my sister, who lives in France, had a surgery the day before, and she was in ICU. So when you've lost one sister and you have five sisters, the rest of the three, you wash them with a hawk's eye. So I get on this red eye to fly to New York, to fly back to Ghana that same day. I sit next to a guy in his Crips white suit. He's taking off his jacket. I had changed my clothes at the airport, so I wore one of those African boo-boo just to be relaxed on my flight, slippers, tie my head, and I fell asleep. So we didn't talk to each other. I think I was the only woman in that business class on that flight who wasn't corporate looking, or, you know. So I slept, and in the morning we landed in New York, and I put my phone on, voice message Phil. Text message inbox fill. My heart sank. don't tell me my sister have died and I'm getting all of this sympathy. So I went to the first text message and it was from Abby. I remember vividly, Nobel. I told you, my friend, you are going to win it one day.
This is Abby who had done the movie.
Yes.
About your life, an inspiring movie.
And then I went to my voice message and my husband was, he said, I'm sitting here crying. I can't move. You won the Nobel Peace Prize. So I turned to this guy sitting next to me and said, sir, I think I just won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he looked at me like, so I didn't look like this, no. I looked like, and then the guy in front of us overheard the conversation, whip out his BlackBerry, and he pulled the picture, turned and looked at me. He said, yep, kiddo, I bet you did. In that moment, I was hugging every man on that flight, even the ones that were sitting next to me that I didn't know.
Wow.
And then Abby called and said, don't move. Get off the flight. We're coming to get you. It's crazy. Like, the whole, everything changed. And I had a speaking that afternoon at the church center at by Riverside Church. And
oh, in New York City.
I was going to speak and then go on a flight. They could barely fill the room. And by 10 that morning, it was standing room only. So, I been picked up by Abby, got to her apartment. I have to find something decent to wear because there's the media coming to interview me. We do not have an assistant for me. So people are calling, wanting to talk to me. They have to grab my phone from me. It's just like, what the hell is going on here? And then I go into...
What was going through your mind?
Nothing. I was like, I wasn't emotional. I couldn't cry. I couldn't laugh because it was unbelievable. And then I get to Liberia the next day. And there's this sea of white on the airport.
Oh, wow. Because your movement, all the women had worn white.
Everyone came.
It was a symbol of.
So I got off the flight and just knelt down and started praising God. And we go right back to the airfield where it all started, and there was this huge celebration that day. People had traveled from their villages to come and see me and see what is this that they said I had won.
And this was a movement that had started with a handful of women and
$10. We were seven women when I started in $10. Seven and $10.
And you won a Nobel Prize. How do you think the prize has changed your life?
Oh, my God, I barely sleep in my bed for 30 days. If I spend 2 weeks at home, that's a long stretch. But it's changed it. Places that I never imagined someone from my background, the girl from in that closely knitted partial slum community, will be sitting with kings and queens and presidents and leaders of the world, and her voice would be counted in conversations.
And her voice would be counted in conversations. After winning the Nobel Prize, she started the Lema Bowie Peace Foundation Africa. It's located in Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. Their mission is to help children finish their schooling and to train students in peace building, sexual health, human rights, and leadership. Lema Bowie's now also executive director of the Women, Peace, and Security Program at Columbia University. The documentary film made about her and the Liberian women's peace movement is called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. She spoke with the Washington Post's Mary Jordan for the Academy of Achievement in the fall of 2018.
Where do you think the path ahead is going to lead you?
I don't know, but I'm trusting God that it's going to be a good path. Whether it leads me into, my husband and I, our dream is to retire in our village on our 50-acre farm. Whether if that is where God leads me and I'm teaching a community school, awesome. If it leads me into being a great politician, awesome. If it leads me on the world stage, awesome. Wherever it leads me, I know there are good things ahead. That's all I know. good things are ahead of me.
I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement. What It Takes is funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you, as always, for listening.